It's scary enough to return to your home to find it has been burglarized, but even more terrifying when you are at home when the thieves invade. It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. We'll hear how Des Moines police have been searching for suspects who have broken into occupied homes and, in some cases, violently accosted the home's residents. Also on the program, the debate over an EPA proposal to lower the amount of ethanol in our fuel. Iowa Secretary of State Matt Schultz will tell us about charges in 9 more voter fraud cases. We'll look at 2 new studies as well, one showing Iowa is one of the most dangerous states to drive in, and another showing part of eastern Iowa is one of the least Bible-minded areas in the country. That's all coming up right after a look at this hour's news. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, and you've arrived at a News Buzz edition of our program. We'd love to do this on Fridays to have a quick set of conversations about some of the news stories that we didn't otherwise touch on during our talk shows this week. Later, we're going to be talking with Iowa Public Radio's Clay Masters about the EPA considering lowering the amount of ethanol in the fuel supply. And depending on who you ask, this could have a significant economic impact on Iowa corn growers. That coming up in just a moment. Later in the program, also, Iowa Secretary of State Matt Schultz joins us. He'll talk about his decision to charge 9 more voter fraud cases. And did you know that Iowa was recently ranked one of the most dangerous states to drive in? We'll find out about that. But first, it's scary enough to return to your home to find it has been burglarized. But even more terrifying, no doubt, when you are at home when the thieves invade. Des Moines police have spent the first few weeks of this year searching for suspects who have broken into occupied homes and in some instances violently accosted the home's residents. Since January 1st, police have investigated 8 home invasions. Now, we keep in mind that only 11 were reported in all of last year. Joining us to tell us more about the rash of home invasions, Regina Zilbermintz. She is a reporter at the Des Moines Register who's been covering this. Hi, Regina.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
This is very disturbing. Tell us what's been happening.
Well, each case has been a little different, but generally what happens is a homeowner is inside their house and a group of men force their way inside. Sometimes they're armed. Sometimes they assault the homeowner. And then they just proceed to search for really whatever item they came there for.
Mm-hmm. You've interviewed some of the victims?
Yes. Yes. I talked to a young lady named Kira Fallis.
Mm-hmm. What was the experience she described? It has to be just an awful experience.
Yeah. So she lives on the east side of Des Moines. And she was just in her house one afternoon with a friend when she saw a friend of hers coming up the path. A group of 3 men. They forced their way through her front door. They knocked her backwards. She fell and hit her head on a coffee table. She was 9 weeks pregnant at this point as well.
Mm.
They also assaulted her friend and then just really proceeded to ransack the entire house.
Mm-hmm. Did they say anything while they were doing this? Why they did this?
She says that they didn't say anything.
Mm-hmm. Did she know them?
Yes. One of them was an acquaintance, and another one was what she described as a very good friend of hers, someone she'd known for years.
Mm-hmm. And have they apprehended the people who did this?
Police have caught 2 of them, thanks in part to the fact that Kira could identify them.
Mm-hmm. So what have the Des Moines police have to say about the home invasions at this point? You say they seem to be unrelated, but why all at once all of these home invasions?
You know, at this point, police are saying it seems like a coincidence that they're all happening so close together. They have not found any connection between any of them.
Hmm. Okay. What else are the police saying?
Well, they're saying that one similarity between them is that in every case, there's at least some connection between the victim and the suspects. In some cases, they're friends, as in Kira Fallis' case. Sometimes they might be criminal associates, and other times they're just acquaintances, mm-hmm. friends of friends that may have heard that there's a valuable item or cash inside the home.
Any sort of drug-related activity to do with this?
Yes. So of the past 18 home invasions, 7 are believed to be drug-related.
Mm-hmm. And are they confined to a certain part of Des Moines?
You know, they're kind of happening all over the city at this point.
Okay. Now, it's interesting to think here, Regina, that a big difference here is that home invasions, if you burglarize a home while it's occupied and do what's been done in the cases that you've described, it carries a much bigger risk for the perpetrators, doesn't it?
Yes, absolutely. As a police officer I was talking to said, you can break into just about any house and be pretty much guaranteed to find something valuable, some sort of electronics. Those cases, third-degree burglaries, have a very low solve rate. And if you are caught, they carry a penalty of up to 5 years in prison. Once you move to home invasions, which are first-degree burglaries, you're much more likely to be apprehended. And if you are, that carries up to 25 years in prison. Now, that's why police are saying, as a general rule, the suspects are after something very specific to take a risk like that.
Mm-hmm. So they're after something that requires people to be at home?
Yes. In the drug-related cases, that's obviously what they're looking for. In other cases, they may have heard that there's a high-priced item inside the house, but they don't know where it is, so they need the homeowner there to hand it over.
Mm-hmm. Looking forward, what are the police saying about perhaps prevention in the Des Moines community?
Sure. So the first thing they say is to be very careful who you tell about valuables in your home. You never know when a friend could mention something to a friend, mention something to an acquaintance. So be careful who you share that with. If someone does break into your home, though, the best bet is just to comply, to hand over whatever they're demanding, although legally a homeowner is within their rights to defend themselves inside their house.
Has this happened in any cases? Have people had, for instance, guns at home to fend off the invaders?
Yes, actually, in the first case that happened this year, two young men broke into a house in Des Moines. The homeowner did shoot one of them, and police arrested both.
So, Regina, what rights do homeowners have when their home is invaded like this?
Well, Iowa, as with most states, has what's known as a castle doctrine, which means that inside your own home, you can use force up to and including deadly force to defend yourself. Now, even though police explain that legality, they do caution that it's up to the homeowner to decide whether their stuff is worth someone's life, and that's an individual decision.
Mm-hmm. Have there been other cases? Tell us about another case that you've come across in this rash of invasions.
Sure. There was one case where a 15-year-old boy was actually homesick from school one afternoon. And a group of men burst into his condo. They threatened him with a machete and had him sit on a couch while they searched for something in the apartment. And it never really was clear whether something was taken.
On that note, I'm reminded of a new study just a few days ago, actually a review of 15 studies that having guns in the home triples the risk of suicide and doubles the risk of homicide. And this is a look at 15 studies across the country over the last few years, that clear association between gun ownership and violent death here in the U.S., and a third of us in the U.S. Own firearms. So we have to keep that in mind, too. But what else is being said about prevention? I guess it can be as basic as locking and bolting your door.
Absolutely. Locking your doors, having a security system is a good option. Keeping valuables kind of away from windows so it's not obvious that you have something in the house. Really simple things like that can be very helpful.
Mm-hmm. Now, also in Des Moines recently, there's been a spate of shootings as well. Was this Monday that we had a number of incidents? Tell us about them.
Sure. So Monday evening, within the space of just 3 hours, there were 4 shootings in Des Moines. In one of them, a person was hit. A young man was shot twice. We're told he did not. The injuries were not life-threatening. In 2 instances, a home was hit, and in 1 case, a car was hit. And in each of those, there were people inside the houses and cars at the time.
Mm-hmm. And what are the police saying is behind these shootings?
They're thinking that it was a series of retaliatory shootings at this point. It's just so early in the year for this kind of activity to start up that it's very unlikely there were 4 completely unrelated shootings in one night.
You say so early. So we're talking about gang-related violence, which is usually more prevalent in the warmer months, right?
Absolutely. This is very early for it to start up. If you think back to last year, there was a big concern when we started seeing gunfire and street-level violence early in the spring, and that was in March. So this is even 2 months back from that.
Mm-hmm. People are listening to us statewide and beyond the borders of Iowa, Regina. How much of a gang problem does Des Moines have?
It's a different gang problem than they had before, and one that's a little difficult to measure. The gangs in Des Moines right now are local. They're not the regional gangs that we saw in the early 90s. They're pretty loosely affiliated, but as always, they do have guns. They're shooting those guns, and the big concern, of course, is that those bullets have to go somewhere.
Mm-hmm. And again, is that pertaining to one part of the city more than others?
Most of the gang activity right now is concentrated in neighborhoods sort of northwest of downtown.
Okay. Regina Zilbermans, thank you very much. You've been reporting on the rash of home invasions and the shootings for the Des Moines Register. I want to thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
You don't believe I'm thinking. Look at the hole I'm in.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Still to come, how Bible-minded are we here in Iowa? What is being Bible-minded anyway? We'll find out about a new study about the Bible here in Iowa in the second half of our program. Also, a conversation with Iowa Secretary of State Matt Schultz coming up. But here's something to consider first. Consider the next time you fill up your gas tank with an ethanol mix. With ethanol made from corn here in Iowa, elected officials and biofuel supporters in Iowa and other ag states are trying to pressure the Obama administration to do away with proposed cuts to the renewable fuel standard. Now, that's a federal mandate requiring set amounts of biofuels to be mixed in with our fuel supply each year. Joining me now to explain it, Clay Masters, our morning edition host here at Iowa Public Radio, also reporter at Iowa Public Radio. Hi, Clay.
Good afternoon, Ben.
So tell us, what is the standard now? And it has to do with an EPA standard, right? What is the now standard now and what is being proposed?
We're talking about a percentage of ethanol that's blended into the gasoline supply. Right now, it's gasoline with about 10% ethanol, and it's become the standard nationwide. And what they're proposing, what the EPA is proposing, is scaling back the amount of ethanol that's blended into our fuel.
So the proposal is to scale back this standard. And you attended an event where Iowans and some of our officials spoke out about this. What happened there? When was it?
Yeah. So earlier this week, well, it was yesterday, there was a hearing held at the World Food Prize building here in Des Moines. And public comment on this EPA decision ends next week. There was a meeting earlier, it was late last year, a meeting in Virginia. Governor Branstad wanted to hold a hearing here in Iowa. He invited the feds, he invited the EPA to come to Des Moines for a hearing about the ethanol industry and, you know, to kind of come to ground zero where we're the top producing ethanol state in the country. The feds said, no, we've had a hearing. We don't need to come. So the governor held this hearing without the feds coming here. And there were representation from many of the corn-producing states, from Nebraska, from Indiana, a lot of people from Iowa. Secretary Bill Northey was there. And here's a little bit of what he had to say.
The legality of EPA being able to do this outside of their authority to grant waivers is in huge question. Most of us would say in this room, it is not legal what they did. They can't pick and choose something that was not legally provided for them in the law to choose to say this is the basis of a waiver.
Iowa Secretary of Agriculture Bill Northey there, if I can jump in here, Clay, and ask, you know, what is the legality of the EPA changing this standard at this point?
Well, it's really garnered bipartisan opposition in the state. Both the Iowa House and Senate have passed resolutions in support of leaving the ethanol blend levels the way they are. But any decision that's going to have to happen is going to come from the federal level, from the EPA. And this is something that they've proposed that they're going to do. Earlier in the week, we heard a piece from Grant Gerlach from Harvest Public Media, and he lays it out pretty well, and I think we can throw a link to it up on our Facebook page. Mm-hmm. So in 2013, the industry basically ran into a blend wall, and then in 14, now the EPA is proposing that the industry just take a step back and throws the future of renewable fuels in doubt. Bruce Babcock was quoted. He's an Iowa State economist. He was quoted in Grant's piece as saying, you know, if you use EPA's logic, we'll never move beyond this blend wall, because to get past it, you have to get past E10, which is that 10% of ethanol, and you have to fill more flex fuel cars with ethanol blends that are even higher. You know, you see these E85 ethanol blends at many gas stations across Iowa. And Babcock explained in the piece that there's a problem, that there's only about 2% of gas stations in the U.S. actually offer E85, and they're concentrated in the Midwest. And then, you know, there's an argument that Governor Branstad made early on as this discussion first started playing out, that more and more car manufacturers are putting out flex fuel cars that rely on more and more ethanol. And when you scale back that, there's less of an incentive for these ethanol companies to produce their product.
Mm-hmm. Were there any other voices you heard at that hearing in Iowa?
There were a lot. There were primarily Republicans. As I mentioned, this has garnered bipartisan opposition in the state. There was an appearance made by a fired-up Congressman Steve King.
When you look at what's here, it's good for the environment. It's good for the economy. It's 45,000 jobs. It gives us independence. And when you have an administration that can't make a decision on a Keystone XL pipeline, but can make a decision on this to back an industry up and freeze it in place and what, weaken it so the petroleum industry can buy it out at a few cents on the dollar, there will be support for it then if they own it. Right now, they're locking the competition out.
Iowa Congressman Steve King of our 4th District. So he mentioned the oil industry. When we step back from this and let the details fade a little bit, isn't this a fight that pits the oil industry against the biofuels industry?
Yeah, and the American petroleum industry, there have been many robocalls that have been hitting Iowa homes, basically saying, you know, this is a chance to let the industry speak for itself, and there are oil companies that see this as an opportunity. Congressman King brought up that it's good for the environment, but there was also an Associated Press article that was published late in the year, last year, that basically said that there's a secret environmental cost of U.S. ethanol policy. This had many groups here in Iowa up in arms as well. The article alleges that because they're tearing down more and more parts of conservation reserve program land and planting that to corn that gets turned into ethanol, that it's having negative impacts on the state's environment and other corn-producing states. Many politicians were frustrated by that. So this is a conversation that started last year, and it's up to the feds to make a decision on whether or not they're going to change the renewable fuel standard, but we'll just have to wait and watch.
Mm-hmm. I see that our senators, also in neighboring states, in Illinois, as well as Chuck Grassley here in Iowa, also Al Franken in Minnesota, in Minnesota, senators, 26 senators in total, sending a letter to the Environmental Protection Agency Administrator Gina McCarthy, asking the agency to amend the proposal for the standard that was released in November. So we don't know how it will turn out. Do we know when we will have a final decision, Clay?
Well, public comment ends on Tuesday, so they will start the process of wrapping up this public comment period, and these things always take a little bit of time. And you bring up Gina McCarthy, and it was interesting this summer she actually came to Iowa, to Des Moines, to the Iowa State Fair, and spoke to Governor Branstad and members of the Farm Bureau. We had some community activist groups and environmentalists that were frustrated that she was coming to the Iowa State Fair and speaking to some of these other groups and not speaking with them. She did meet with them for a little while, but, you know, the governor has said that, you know, he thought that she was on the same page with him. So, well, like you mentioned, we'll just have to wait and see, but I would imagine we won't stop hearing about this anytime soon.
Okay. Thank you very much, Clay Masters, Morning Edition host and reporter at Iowa Public Radio. As a matter of fact, Clay, you'll be in the host seat here on River to River on Monday morning when you broadcast live from the State House, won't you?
That's right, Ben. We'll be talking about minimum wage. The president's likely to be talking about the minimum wage in his State of the Union address on Tuesday. There's been a lot of conversation about the minimum wage here in the state. We'll talk with a journalist in Iowa who's talked with a lot of people who are on minimum wage in the state. We'll talk to somebody who's studied minimum wage's impact on different industries. And then, of course, we'll be in the Capitol, so we'll pick the brains of some of our lawmakers.
Mm-hmm. And I imagine callers and tweeters and emailers are welcome to join the conversation, especially if they're getting by on a minimum wage.
Yeah, we want to hear from those that are on minimum wage, those that who have been on minimum wage, as well as employers about how they think that would impact their business.
Iowa Public Radio's Clay Masters, thanks again.
Thanks, Ben.
In the time before the break, I might mention that Iowa made national news this week in a couple of stories. On Thursday, the Today Show named Des Moines as America's wealthiest city on the show's Healthy, Wealthy, Wise series. The show cited affordability, business growth, and green space as reasons for the Des Moines ranking. And Ames also made national news this week as Iowa State landed a spot on the most haunted colleges list. Mystery's Heartland, that's a blog that shares quirky facts about the Midwest, ranked Iowa State University number 5 out of 10 in the most haunted schools in the Midwest. One of the most notorious ghost stories from Iowa State includes rumors surrounding Iowa State's Fisher Theater, which is said to be haunted by the ghost of Frederica Shattuck. That's a woman who contributed to the university's theater department. According to students, you can hear disembodied voices and a wheelchair that reportedly belonged to Shattuck that moves around the theater. Coming up after a short break, as News Buzz continues here on Iowa Public Radio, we'll talk with Iowa Secretary of State Matt Schultz. He'll tell us about his decision to charge 9 more voter fraud cases. Most of them are felons who mistakenly believe their voter rights have been restored. And Iowa was recently ranked one of the most dangerous states to drive in. We'll talk with someone from the Governor's Traffic Safety Bureau to find out if we deserve that ranking. Also, another study that looks at how Bible-minded people are across the country. And it turns out part of eastern Iowa is one of the least Bible-minded parts of the country. We'll find out what that means when we talk with Robert Cargill. He's a professor in the Department of Religious Studies at the University of Iowa. That's all coming up when we return. This is a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer.
Support comes
back with more of a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Still to come a little later in the hour, we'll look at two new studies, one showing Iowa as one of the most dangerous states to drive in, and another showing part of eastern Iowa as one of the least Bible-minded areas in the country. We'll discuss those a little bit later in the program. But first, this week, Iowa Secretary of State Matt Schultz announced charges in 9 additional voter fraud cases. This is the latest in the ongoing effort by his office to identify and investigate such fraud. Joining us now is Iowa Secretary of State Matt Schultz. Secretary, welcome back to our program.
Thanks, Ben. I appreciate it.
Tell us about these new cases. All 9 cases, I understand, concern felons who voted in the 2012 general election, but did not have their voting rights restored to do so?
Well, eight of the cases were that. The case, I believe, in Lee County, I think, was a city election, but in 2013, but I'm not entirely sure on that. But yes, they are all felons who had voted who had not had their voting rights restored.
And eight of them from Blackhawk County, the Waterloo City.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yep. Eight of them up in Blackhawk County. And so, you know, this is a situation where these cases were referred to DCI by our office or the county auditor's office. And they did the investigations and then brought them to the county attorneys, and the county attorneys made the decision to file charges in those cases.
Mm-hmm. Now, you mentioned that the DCI, the Iowa Division of Criminal Investigation, has a dedicated investigator for these voting fraud cases for you there. Now,
correct.
Now, rights restoration was almost automatic for felons. It was an automatic process for several years until, correct me if I'm wrong, until Governor Branstad returned to office in 2011, and he reinstated an application process. So it didn't come back to you automatically after you were released from prison. In these cases, these new nine cases, couldn't it be that these people were simply mistaken in thinking that their voting rights were automatically restored because it's only been since 2011 that you have an application process?
Yeah, I don't believe so. You'd have to ask the county attorneys or the DCI specifically on these cases, but I believe these individuals were on probation and signed documents that stated that they knew they couldn't vote. But that really would be a better question for the county attorney, mm-hmm. and I think that's why the county attorney actually decided to move forward with these cases because it wasn't necessarily a case of a mistake, but that these individuals should have known what they were doing.
Let me ask you, Matt Schultz, does that make a difference in your eyes, voting by mistake, a genuine mistake, as opposed to voting when you know it's illegal?
Well, you know, for sure that's something that needs to be weighed by the courts. For me, I don't rule as judge or jury in these cases. I don't even have the ability to decide who gets prosecuted or not. I give this information to DCI, and they do their investigations and they give it to the county attorneys, and the county attorneys make those decisions. I think if you look at the cases so far, especially those five people who have pled guilty to election misconduct, most of them paid fines. I don't think they did jail time as a result, and I'm sure all of those things were considered by the judge and the county attorney when they did their deals. And so those are decisions for a jury, those are decisions for a judge, and those are decisions that the county attorneys make. Mm-hmm. So not every case gets prosecuted for that reason. They have that discretion. We just have evidence that people voted who aren't eligible to vote, and we give that information over, and then the judicial system works.
How long, Secretary Schultz, has your office been going on with this effort to identify and investigate voter fraud?
About a year and a half. Mm-hmm. We've had a DCI agent assigned to our office.
You have five convictions in that year and a half, and I think that how much does it cost for this DCI agent, or just to be specific?
I think we've spent $150,000 so far on the investigations, with 26 cases having charges filed so far.
Do you think Iowans think it's worth it to get what is a handful of convictions and in this case, and in some cases, just mistakenly voting when they thought they could?
Well, I think that there's a couple things here. First of all, you never judge it, using a sports analogy. You never judge a game until the game's over, and there are going to be more cases that I believe will come up over the next several months. Having said that, I think it's important to protect our vote, our right to vote, and when people who aren't eligible to vote actually vote, then they're canceling out the vote of a legitimate voter. Mm-hmm. And you can't quantify the deterrence of people who may want to cheat, because clearly not everybody is just making mistakes. If anybody's insinuating that, that's just not the truth. Otherwise, people wouldn't have pled guilty. And otherwise, county attorneys wouldn't have brought charges in these cases. And so, I think this is really a situation where you just have to ask yourself, are you willing to have investigations done? And even if we were to spend the maximum amount of money that we could with it, that'd be 6.5 cents a voter, a registered voter. I think, you know, we spend more money just to maintain the list of registered voters than we do on these investigations.
You seem to indicate that there may be many more to come. You're continuing this effort, it sounds like. Do you expect a bulge, a number of more than this handful to come as you continue the investigation?
I can't control what county attorneys do and don't do. I know DCI has investigated more than this, and that they are taking these cases to county attorneys as they complete their investigations, and I expect that to continue over the next several months. Mm-hmm. And so I've always said, even last time we talked, there'd be more cases coming, and sure enough, there's 9 more cases. And so I can't get into the specifics of each case because, number one, I don't know all the specifics. We give that, the initial information, and then DCI does the investigation. And then they take the information to the county attorneys, who will have the ultimate decision whether or not they're prosecuted. These cases really are out of my hands once I give that information to DCI.
Secretary Schultz, before we say goodbye, I want to mention you have, of course, announced that you will run as a Republican for Congress in 2014, vying for the 3rd District seat that Tom Latham is vacating. How prominent of a theme will voter fraud be in your campaign?
Well, my campaign is about fixing Washington and about integrity. And for me, we need to repeal Obama's health care law. We need a constitutional amendment requiring a balanced budget, and I believe we need a constitutional amendment for term limits for politicians. And so, to me, that's a theme of integrity. I obviously fought for integrity in elections as Secretary of State, and I will continue the theme of having integrity in Washington.
Iowa Secretary of State Matt Schultz, thank you for joining us live.
Thank you, Ben. I appreciate it.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. Let's look at a couple of studies as we steer, should I say, toward the end of the hour carefully. Iowa, along with Nebraska, are among the worst states in enacting safer driving laws. Now, that's according to a new report released this week by a highway safety group. In its Roadmap to State Highway Safety Laws, the Washington, D.C.-based Advocates for Highway and Auto Safety gave both states, Iowa and our neighbor, Nebraska, a danger rating for the second straight year. It was a group of 11 states ranked the most dangerous for driving. Patrick Hoy is with us, Bureau Chief at the Governor's Traffic Safety Bureau. Welcome back to our program, Pat.
Well, thanks, Ben. I appreciate you having me on.
Are you surprised by this ranking?
I actually was extremely surprised when I saw this report that came out. I think there's times when you take a look at documents that come out 2 weeks prior to this report coming out, the car insurance industry put out their annual report. It's called carinsurancecomparison.com, and they lifted which states have the safest highways, and I was pleasantly surprised that Iowa was ranked number one. So when the car industry did their report, they said, who has the safest highways in the country? Iowa ranked number one. So coming off that report, and then when this one, I picked this report up, it was like I just was shocked.
Okay, let's dig into the methodology here a little bit in the details, and perhaps we can discover why there the mismatch is, as you mentioned there. This group in this latest survey outlined 15 recommended safety laws and based its ratings on whether the states have enacted those laws. Now, Iowa, at the bottom of this list, had only enacted 5 of the recommended laws. So that's their measure, right?
Correct. It is.
Mm-hmm. And so why aren't we better than that in comparison to other states?
Well, I think the overall picture, and when you're truly talking traffic safety, what we take a look at is, are your roads safe? And, when we took a look at, for example, like 2012, we lost 365 lives in Iowa. Last year, 2013, 317. 13% decrease. It was one of the most significant declines in the country, happened right here in Iowa. So, what we try to do is take an overall look in traffic safety. Obviously, laws are certainly a big part of the overall picture, but enforcement, engineering, education, EMS services, all of it ties in. So to us, you know, when the title came out, 11 Most Dangerous States, we certainly disagreed with that.
Okay. For the 10 laws that Iowa has, the recommended laws by this group that Iowa has not enacted, what would you say are the ones that we should enact that would have the most impact on further reducing fatalities, injuries on our roadways?
Well, I think, you know, when you take a look at all of those, you know, safety advocates will tell us that, you know, by enacting these laws, we believe they would have an impact on the fatality and serious injury count. The ones that, for example, I know on Tuesday, I had the opportunity to be over at the Capitol and visit with senators, and they're taking a look at this, the distracted driving law here in Iowa.
Distracted driving meaning what exactly?
Well, I think it's going to encompass, they're looking at the amount of, whether it be putting on makeup, reading a paper, texting and driving. I think all of that falls under distracted driving. And I think they're having serious discussions on, you know, what is the best way to approach it. I think they'll probably have conversations, you know, at the Capitol, seatbelts for all persons in a vehicle. I think those are some of the laws that they'll be debating and working through during this legislative session.
Right. And right now we have seatbelt laws, what, only for people in the front seat?
Correct. And over the age of 18, if you're under 18, it's everywhere in the vehicle. If you're over 18 in the back seat, you're not.
What about texting? This has been proven again and again by studies to be really a distraction. And hardly a day goes by when I don't, give an evil stare to someone who is looking more at their mobile device than the roadway while I'm driving.
I agree with you. It is, you know, I think all of us can point, no matter how far you drive, where you spot someone that is texting and driving, and it certainly falls into that realm of distracted driving. And I think those are the things that our legislators this session will be taking a look at. And you know, I think when I looked at the report, you know, obviously you never want to be a red state here, but you know, we have had a very good. Safety advocates have had a good relationship with the governor's office and our senators and our representatives. You know, this January we came out with an enhanced GDL law. So, I mean, to me, the picture painted a very bleak, but, you know, can we improve? Absolutely. But, you know, I truly don't think the report portrayed, you know, the true great work that does come out of the governor's office and our legislators.
Patrick Hoy of the Governor's Traffic Safety Bureau. Thank you very much, Pat, for joining us again.
Hey, Ben, I appreciate the time. Thank you.
Okay, let's finish up with another study in a completely different direction. How Bible-minded are you? Yes, I said Bible-minded. The two least Bible-minded in the cities in the country are the adjacent metropolitan areas of Providence, Rhode Island, and New Bedford, Massachusetts. That's according to a study out this week from the American Bible Society. Now, you may be asking yourself, what is Bible-mindedness? Well, this organization, the American Bible Society, says it's a combination of how often respondents read the Bible and how accurate they think the Bible is. Respondents who report reading the Bible within the past 7 days and who agree strongly in the accuracy of the Bible are classified as Bible-minded, according to this study's methodology. Tennessee is, suggested by the report, the state that is most devout in our union. Chattanooga was found to be the most Bible-minded city in America. It's a title it won from last year's victor, Knoxville, Tennessee. Well, how did Iowa fare in this study? It turns out that Cedar Rapids and Waterloo turned up on the list of least Bible-minded cities. Joining me now to talk about the survey and its significance, Robert Cargill, professor in the Department of Religious Studies at the University of Iowa, and professor of Classics and Religious Studies, also an archaeologist. Bob Cargill, welcome back to our program.
Thanks for having me back, Ben.
I want to mention, too, that last time we had you on, and perhaps we can talk a little bit about it, you're biblical authority who's appeared in many documentaries on TV. You have a project that just wrapped up, a six-part documentary called Bible Secrets Revealed. And perhaps it ties into this conversation. But first of all, what's your reaction to this survey? What's its significance?
I think it's a very good thing, and I'll explain why I think this is, that this eastern part of Iowa is actually listed among the least Bible-minded. And I say it's a good thing for a couple of reasons. One, there is a correlation between the education levels and intelligence of state's residents and what this study would show as more Bible-minded. So when you look at – and I posted a blog on this earlier today. If you look at surveys that look at, you know, how many people graduate from high school, percentage with the graduate degrees, that is inversely proportionate to what this would say is Bible-mindedness. So what it says is that just as Boston, which is on the list there, and San Francisco and Berkeley and the Bay Area are these very highly understood to be highly intellectual cities, there right here in the upper Midwest is eastern Iowa, you know, representing a relatively highly educated population. The other problem is with the survey. The survey has two criteria. One, how frequently do you read the Bible? And two, how accurate do you find the Bible?
Yeah, what do you make of that word, accurate?
Yeah, and that's the thing. They leave it undefined. They leave it up to the respondent to define this on their own. Does that mean that the respondent sees accuracy of the Bible as inerrancy or infallibility? Something that biblical literalist, fundamentalist would say, well, that, you know, the Bible is inerrant or infallible. But progressive Christians, very devout, very confessing Christians would say, well, no, I don't really think that a six-day creation is accurate. I don't think that the story of the biblical flood is accurate. And a recent Pew Research poll shows that 66% now of confessing Christians accept human evolution. But within that group of Christians, we also find that same poll showed that white evangelical Protestants, 66% of them still appeal to a six-day creation. So what you're seeing here is basically a correlation. If you look at the top five, they're all in the Bible Belt. They're all in the South. We would call them all red states. There's a correlation in this survey between conservative Christianity, or maybe it would be biblical biblical literalism or fundamentalism and Bible-mindedness. Whereas you can have all kinds of confessing faithful Christians who are progressive Christians who maybe read the Bible differently who would be considered not Bible-minded.
So the methodology tells you that perhaps the American Bible Society has a literal agenda here in interpreting the Bible.
But they do, and they left themselves some leeway by saying, well, we didn't define this. But what it is by using the word accuracy, they're not saying how relevant is the Bible to your life or how much of your life depends upon the ethics or what is taught by the Bible. They're saying how accurate it is. And we don't know how much to weigh that. There are very, very good progressive Christian communities. I'm thinking of First Presbyterian Church here in Iowa City, Sam Massey, and what he preaches every Sunday. These are devout Christians who would be considered progressive Christians. They might not accept a literal six-day creation or a literal biblical flood, and yet if that's weighed on in the survey as not being biblical-minded, then it might reflect poorly.
Before the hour gets away from us, I wanted to ask you about the documentary series that you had a hand in that just wound up. You've been biblical authority in over a dozen documentaries on TV, and the latest, Bible Secrets Revealed, just wound up, a six-part documentary.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering, after you investigated Bible Secrets, what kind of reaction was there across the nation to this series?
You know, the reaction to the series, and this is looking at Twitter, looking at Facebook, looking at emails, handwritten emails that I received from Iowa residents and people around the nation, it wasn't very different than the results of this survey.
How so?
That is to say that I got a lot of feedback from people saying, finally, history is putting some actual history on the History Channel, right? There's actually some real history. There are real scholars, teaching incredible universities, both conservative Christian universities and secular universities. And so a lot of people said, finally, we got history on history. Others, conservatives, would say, how dare you even challenge anything that the Bible says? So that, I think, is reflected in this survey that we just discussed.
Mm-hmm. Any big surprises for you from listeners?
No, I think there was an appreciation and a gratitude that there's finally a show that was taking real scholars and asking them, you know, kind of the entry-level stuff that you'd get in a graduate seminary. These aren't new revelations. These are things that you would learn in a seminary, but might be new to the public.
Got 30 seconds to please tell us, as a University of Iowa archaeologist and religious scholar, what's next on your plate that we may see turn up nationally or otherwise?
We are leading a new excavation, Tel Azekah. This is about 30 minutes west of Jerusalem. The University of Iowa Study Abroad is sponsoring this. Any University of Iowa student, any people of the University of Iowa can come with us and dig, do real biblical archaeology at Tel Azekah. It's mentioned in the Bible several times. That's probably what you'll see from us next.
Always when you're on, Bob Cargill, I think we've just carved too little time for you because you're so fascinating in your studies and your research. Bob Cargill, professor, assistant professor of classics and religious studies at the University of Iowa, archaeologist, also specializing in Judaism and Christianity. Thanks for coming in again, Bob.
Thanks for having me.
River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury, Sarah Bowden, and Ben Stanton. Help from John Pemble in Des Moines today. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. Clay Masters will be in the River to River host chair on Monday, live from the state capitol. I'm Ben Kiefer. Have a great weekend. Thanks for joining us.
Will ever be my key to memory. At the end of day when work was over, and when the evening meal was done, Dad would read to us from the family Bible. And we'd count our many blessings one by one. I can see